Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
People don't have a really great understanding of the origins of COVID-19, the fact that it did come from animals, and that it specifically came from animals that are kept in conditions that are very similar to the way we keep almost all of our farmed animals in North America.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. For the months of May and June, Species Unite is celebrating plant-based eating with Vegan Nights. Vegan Nights really just means we'd love for you to invite friends over or just cook for your family, but make a plant-based meal. Take a photo, post it to Instagram with the hashtag Species Unite Vegan Nights, and you will be entered to win one of six $275 gift baskets filled with all sorts of vegan delights. So go to our website to sign up, speciesunite.com. This conversation is with Joe Anderson. Joe is the research director at Faunalytics. Faunalytics is an organization that empowers animal advocates with access to research, analysis, strategies, and messages that maximize effectiveness to reduce animal suffering. Hi, Joe.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Really good, thank you. Tell me a little bit about you before we even talk about Faunalytics. Did you grow up in thinking about animals in any way, or advocacy, or veganism?
My mom was vegetarian my whole life, since the 70s, I believe.
Why was she vegetarian?
For the animals.
But you guys weren't, or?
We weren't, which I guess is always a choice that parents have to make.
Well, and especially back then.
Yeah, it was really difficult, much harder than now, and my dad wasn't, so.
Right.
So it was always kind of on my radar because of that. It was in my undergrad that I went vegetarian myself, and then kind of didn't think about it for a long time. Ended up going to grad school for social psychology. I was planning on going academic at first and ended up switching into government and then Faunalytics eventually. It was kind of a long and winding road. Once I joined Faunalytics and I was getting exposure to all of the issues a lot of the time, I realized, you know, what vegetarianism was to me was kind of a bit of a shelter from some of those additional pieces of information. And so learning more about it, I ended up going vegan.
That's a really good kind of story, history for someone who does the kind of work you do, because I think it probably gives you a lot of understanding of how, I mean, also social psychology, but of how humans' brains work and what we don't want to see. I'm sure there's a lot there that you already had kind of in your wheelhouse before Faunalytics.
I think so, yes. Social psychology is very useful for that kind of perspective. It is nice that I have that personal perspective of coming from a period of my life where I didn't think about it a whole lot. And if I ever started to think about it, I would feel uncomfortable with some of the ideas and the things that I was learning and would fairly deliberately say, that's enough of learning about, you know, chickens suffering on factory farms. I don't want to know that right now.
For people who've never heard of Faunalytics, what do you guys do?
We are a nonprofit focused on research. So we find journal articles on topics that are relevant to animal advocates about a wide range of things. And we have volunteers who summarize them in a simplified way and in a way that is designed to be useful for someone who wants to help animals.
How does it work at Faunalytics? Are you guys like working on specific studies and research all the time, or new things are coming in? How does kind of the whole big picture of it all work?
In terms of the research, we go through a prioritization cycle where each year we try and gather potential research questions from advocates, people in the movement, based on what they think is important, what they need to know. There's so many things that we need to know as advocates that it's really difficult to even come up with a list that feels comprehensive, let alone actually answer all the questions that we get. But that's the first step we take. And then we look at those questions in terms of how much impact they'll have. We take the ones that will be as impactful as possible and also feasible for us to do to get through, produce data that is meaningful for advocates. And those are the projects we take on. And then people like me will actually do the data collection and write up the results and all of that.
What are some that you're working on now?
Right now, perhaps the one that I am most excited about is one looking at the effectiveness of different advocacy tactics. So you kind of alluded to this earlier by saying some kinds of advocacy seem like they can be really off-putting. Those really in-your-face graphic videos, things like that. We hear that kind of statement a lot, like that is off-putting. But there's actually not great data about that. The goal of this study is to really compare all these different types of advocacy, not every type because, you know, they're infinite, but look at different things like graphic videos online, protests, and even the difference between like a peaceful protest of people just standing with signs versus a disruptive protest of like lying down in traffic or that kind of thing, versus documentaries, versus books, versus a whole bunch of other things. And we're just getting a sense first of whether people have experienced these things and what their reactions to them were, whether they say that they made them reduce their meat consumption, whether they made them angry, other things as well. So really getting an initial reaction to each of those different things that we can then compare. And then we'll follow up as well with some experimental work that I won't get into, but trying to establish more firmly whether seeing those different things causes certain behaviors, positive or negative.
That's actually really fun, doing the experimental work, I'm sure.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I love this study. It's been a long time coming, and I think a lot of advocates are really interested in it and excited about it because it's such a fundamental question in what we do, not just what is the really specific message I'm going to put in this video, but do I use a video or do I go out there with a signboard? What is going to work better?
Which is crazy that no one actually really knows, right?
It is. It's just, from a research perspective, it's one of those questions that is super important, but really difficult because the different types of advocacy are so different. We're taking a stab at it.
I've heard you talk about the how versus why when it comes to talking about veganism. Will you talk about that a little bit? Because I think most vegans, especially new vegans, or really just kind of vegans on a mission, really want to jump into the why.
It's the most obvious piece of the story for a lot of people. This is why we need to do this. This is why it's so important. But it can be difficult to remember that probably even before you, as a vegan doing this kind of work, became vegan, you probably knew some part of the things that later made you vegan. That is to say, on some level, everyone is aware that animals are raised on factory farms, that they are slaughtered, and that the conditions are not good there. At least in the Western world, that's become relatively common information. A lot of the time, what you're trying to overcome by talking to people about changing their diet or their approach to animals is a feeling of not being able to do it, as opposed to not knowing why you should do it. And by not able to, I mean all kinds of things. Either meat is too important to me, I just really love the taste, it's such an important part of my family life, I think that the health and nutrition aspects are really important, right down to living in an area where it's difficult to get alternative proteins. All of those things play in, and in my opinion, play a larger role than lack of education these days. Most people will probably already know a fair bit about those things, even if they haven't looked into it. But knowing the how is just incredibly important for making it seem like an accessible choice for everyone, as opposed to a thing that a few fringe weirdos are doing.
With a lot of people, if you do try and approach them with any sort of like factory farming talk or a video, not only do they not want to know, but it's actually a turnoff. Like they don't want to even consider, you know, a Beyond Burger at that point because they don't want to be associated with that kind of banter. But there's something that I think just compels everybody, especially when they first go vegan, to want to scream it from the rooftops. And it's a big learning curve that I think most people who go stay vegan long enough go through.
Yeah. I don't have data to speak to that, but I will say that that's my personal experience as well, and that of other people that are like our executive director previously, Jay, had been in the movement for decades. And, you know, he said that was his process. He went from a, you know, loud demonstrating vegan, wanting to just shake people to tell them the truth, to over time really coming to appreciate that, okay, I've been doing this for this long. You kind of see the effect that it has or the effect that it doesn't have. And over time realize that that's as appealing as it is emotionally, it's not the most effective strategy.
Well, and I think too, the how, when you talk about the how, it's more of a positive, right? The how is not really a negative conversation ever. And that's kind of where, in a lot of ways, I especially think with the younger vegan movement, it's so positive now that it's way more contagious.
The how really listens to the other person and understands their perspective and like capitalizes on commonalities rather than focusing on what you're doing wrong.
So talk a little more about this study that you did, the reduction versus going flat out vegan.
That one was a study that we did on a university campus, similar to a lot of animal advocacy methods that you see. It showed a video to people who were just passing by, most of whom were students. There were two different groups of people. The video that they saw was the same either way. It shared some health information, environmental information, and animal welfare information about the reasons why eating a lot of meat is a problem. The only difference between the two videos was whether the message that it was promoting while showing this was reduce your meat consumption or go vegetarian. It wasn't even as strong as go vegan in the other condition. Afterward, we gave them a coupon for participating, for watching the video that was just for $5 off at the local coffee shop where they could get a sandwich. We looked at the percentage of purchases of meatless sandwiches from that shop, which had some really nice options like falafel and things like that. And what we found was that the people who had gotten the reduction message were more likely to purchase a meatless sandwich than the people who had gotten the vegetarian message, which feels very counterintuitive. But we do have some insight as to the reason, because at the end of the video, we asked them, are you willing to pledge, like to actually sign your name, to reduce the amount of meat that you eat, for the people who had seen the reduction video? Or are you willing to pledge to go vegetarian for those people? The difference in people who would agree to one of those two things was 60% who said that they were willing to reduce and just 15% who were willing to try going veg.
Wow.
So, just right there, you can see the huge difference. And that's what drove the people who had seen the reduced video to be more likely to then go and order the falafel sandwich instead of the chicken breast.
That's incredible. I'm sure for people who are doing it, it's a lot less scary. Like, it's easy to commit when you're committing to slowing down.
Yeah. And in an ideal world, I mean, we kept this pretty simple because we wanted comparability.
Right.
But in an ideal world, you would go one further and say, you commit to reducing. Now let's talk about that how. So are you going to cut back one meal per week at first and then two meals per week? Are you going to go product by product? But getting people to walk through a plan, making it concrete, would have, I'm sure, made those results even stronger.
I know you guys have done so much research and so many studies, but have there been some that have just shocked you like to the bone in the sense of intuition versus like what's been intuitive versus what's reality?
Oh, geez. You know, your intuition gets a little shot when you go through a psychology program, but from our recent work, I think the thing that comes to mind is a study we did looking at the impact of different animal products on the animals themselves. So the number of lives that go into producing different things, the number of days of suffering, essentially days on a factory farm that go into producing different things. Because a lot of the time when we're thinking about meat reduction, people have a tendency to start with red meat. They'll cut out beef, they'll cut out pork, and then eventually they might cut out chicken. Even more eventually, they might cut out fish. But that's a very health-focused perspective. And what you see from this study is that it's the animals with the small bodies, the fish and the chickens, who obviously have to die in the greatest numbers in order to produce the same amount of product for people to eat. When you look at these scales, the tops of the lists are just dominated by fish products, chicken products, you know, fillets, nuggets, and egg products for chickens as well. Seeing that, I think, can be a little bit of a shock to the system.
I looked at the study and I was shocked. Why are scrambled eggs and omelets number one?
They are right up there just because of the number of days that go into producing those products. Chickens are small and they produce one egg per day for the most part, sometimes a little less. And so in order to get those scrambled eggs and omelets, it's quite a few days of that chicken being on that farm in order to produce the eggs that go into the omelet. On top of that, we took into account all of these other things that go into food production of any kind. There's loss due to the shrinkage of the food when you cook it. There's loss due to food waste. There's mortality of the animals before they even make it to the point of slaughter or production. Some of those chickens just die. So all of those things went into the calculation, as well as many more, all of which are on our site if you want to get into the math of it.
There are a lot of people who, whether they end up going vegan ultimately or not, are much more comfortable either reducing the amount of meat, dairy they eat in general, or going product by product. If someone were to do the product by, you know, the thing by thing kind of way of just reduction, what makes sense in the sense of suffering to start with?
Egg products, fish products, chicken products. Those are going to be number one. Things like fish fillets, scrambled eggs, you already mentioned, chicken nuggets, fish sticks, fish broth, pretty much you name it on the fish, chicken, and egg products. Those are going to be near the top of the list. I'm trying not to promote eating other things instead, but if you're looking at the comparison, dairy products are much lower on the list because cows are larger. You don't need as many of them, and they produce a fair bit of milk, and we don't consume a ton of dairy at a time. So for me personally, when I was cutting back, I cut back slowly to go from vegetarian to vegan, and it made it much easier to think, okay, I'm going to start with eggs because that's where the bigger impact is, and I will eventually make it to dairy, but that means that in the meantime, there are all these things I can still eat to not feel like I'm suffering through this process as much, you know? Just take it a step at a time.
With people who are starting, like right now, Kamala Harris is doing vegan till dinner, which is incredible. And I'm hoping that inspires a lot of people. But for people who are starting that, is there ways that make it stick better than others?
Yeah, there's lots of things. We have done previous research on the difference between people who maintain vegan or vegetarian diets and the people who give them up. There are a lot of differences, but one of the biggest ones is social support. So if you can find people around you who are doing the same thing, who will try it with you, or even better, who already are vegan or vegetarian, to support you, to encourage you, having cheerleaders is so important. And they can also provide really concrete support about where you can find products. And if you don't like the first thing that you try, that person is there to say, oh, I didn't like that one either. Why don't you try this other brand instead? Especially nowadays when there are so many plant-based options, having someone to just point you in the right direction can be really useful. So if you don't have social support kind of built in already, you don't know anyone who's vegan or vegetarian, there's groups online, like all of the different campaigns and organizations often have Facebook groups, and there will be meetup groups locally, all kinds of things that you can do to find others who are like you, trying it for the first time or have been doing it for a long time and are willing to be supports. And I can say for myself and every vegan I've ever met, having someone come to you and say, can you help me go vegan, or can you help me reduce my meat consumption? We love that. That is not a burden. So I don't think that there needs to be any worry about like imposing on your friends or family members. If that's the case, they want to help.
Chances are they'll ask you to stay for dinner. For the month of May, Species Unite is doing a month called Vegan Nights, where we think it's going to be mostly vegans, but you don't have to be vegan. Sign up and they get a packet with recipes and documentary ideas if they want those, and ideas for the night. But basically make dinner for non-vegans and post it, tag us, that sort of thing. It's kind of that message though, like, hey, I'm going to show you really good vegan food.
And we're really excited about it because already we've so many people signing on because vegans want to share. Being vegan's really easy in 2021 and it's really delicious. And so I think that message is starting to get out more too. This research that you've done on the reduction versus straight up go vegan kind of stuff, has this impacted like animal advocacy groups? Are people taking your research with that and using it in their messaging?
Definitely. There's been a growing body of evidence that allowing for reduction, supporting reduction as part of that journey is important and effective and can't be just ignored. And starting in part with a study that we actually did about 5-6 years ago now, the one that I mentioned looking at current versus former vegans and vegetarians, there too, just the number of people who try it and end up giving it up because it's too hard, I think started a lot of the ball rolling in terms of people giving more respect to the idea of helping people in a slower transition if that's what works for them. Some people respond really well to the challenge of just turning it off overnight. No more meat, no more dairy, no more eggs ever again as of right now. But the number of people who are like that is relatively small. And so I think as of that study, we're certainly not going to take full credit for that change, but we are seeing a lot more organizations that talk that way in terms of taking things one step at a time, reducing in the direction of veganism. Melanie Joy is one of my favorite people, and you know, be as vegan as possible. You don't need to be perfectly vegan today. You will probably not be perfectly vegan ever.
Even if you're a vegan, exactly.
Exactly. I am not a perfect vegan.
No.
You know, just accepting that and getting rid of some of that all or nothing thinking is so helpful and something that we are seeing a lot more in the past 5 years or so.
Which is really cool because that's really shifted. One more thing I was reading with you with Funnelytics and COVID and zoonotic diseases and the public and preventing the next pandemic. Will you just talk on this? Because I get in the bubble for sure with this. And I feel like everybody knows that the next pandemic's coming from a factory farm probably. You know, but I think most people don't know a whole lot about this one or the next one in the sense of our relationship with animals and what's happening.
I completely agree. The research that we conducted that you're referring to is actually about a year old at this point. And so, you know, I'm starting to think, should we redo that, see how things stand now? But what we saw and what I think from other evidence is probably still fairly true is that you're right. People don't have a really great understanding of the origins of COVID-19, the fact that it did come from animals, and that it specifically came from animals that are kept in conditions that are very similar to the way we keep almost all of our farmed animals in North America. When we ask people just kind of to type in, you know, where do you think that this came from? Apart from just understanding that it had something to do with animals, only half of the respondents even knew that. And then to get to the level of like the wet market conditions in China, that animals in close proximity, disease spreading from animal to animal and animal to human, that level of nuance was just completely lost on almost everyone. We saw that 16% of people said something about wet markets, which is about as good as it got.
One thing that always kind of perplexes me, and I don't know if it's really a Funnelytics question or just a big, broad question. Most people care about animals and genuinely really do. Most people, you know, don't want harm and suffering. But in terms of growing the animal rights movement and getting more people to advocate for animals or go semi-vegan or vegan, it's a big jump. Considering how many people care about animals, it's still a pretty small movement. How does it grow? What are the things that make it grow?
Some of the things are the things that don't involve talking to individual people. We've seen much more of a movement in the last few years toward corporations going cage-free with their egg supply. And that change is something that has come out through the animal advocacy movement with people going and lobbying those corporations to make that change. Because although it is small and incremental change for the chickens involved, it is a step in the right direction. And it gets around some of those issues of people not changing their behavior, even though they say they care about animals. And I believe that they do care about animals. It's just that issue I spoke about earlier of shoving that information aside or separating it from the fact that you eat meat. A lot of those divisions are there, separations. In psychology, it's called cognitive dissonance. I'm sure you've heard the term. And it just means there's this disconnect between our beliefs and our behavior. And part of what can be useful for overcoming that is to change the behavior first, which sounds really counterintuitive. But if you can get people to buy cage-free eggs or to reduce their consumption for other reasons, like health reasons or environmental reasons, and then get them to think about the fact that this is better for animals, at that point, it becomes less difficult to accept that, oh, that behavior was harmful for animals. So reflecting back on it, now that I've already changed it somewhat, I can see that, yes, I have made a step in the right direction for animals. And then maybe I can go a little further and, you know, cut out some other animal products or not buy eggs at all anymore. You kind of bypass that whole attitude issue to begin with.
For advocates who aren't really aware of Funnelytics or aren't using you in the way that they could really be benefiting from, will you just talk about that a little bit and how they could be?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who wants to help animals, take action for animals, whether that's farmed animals like we've been talking about, or if it's wildlife, companion animals, animals that are used in science, there's something on our site for you. Probably the thing that you'll come across first is the library, where you can type in any keywords. And if what you're interested in is greyhound racing, you will find articles that have looked at some aspects of greyhound racing. If you're looking at dog adoptions, you'll find things about breed characteristics and other stuff like that. Our original research focuses on those topics I mentioned that are really high impact. Often that means farmed animal topics, but sometimes it's topics that apply more broadly to pretty much any type of advocacy, like things about donation. So that's there as well. We also have a section that's research advice, conducting your own research and, you know, how to design a survey. Probably my favorite part of that, because I like talking to people, is we have a virtual office hour where actually two. There's one that I do once a week, and there's one that our content director, Carl, who manages the library, does. And so if you have questions about doing your own research or finding data that you need, our office hours are there, and you just come and do something like a Google Meet session where you just come in and we chat about whatever it is that you need.
That's really cool and so helpful.
I hope so. I love doing it. I love talking to people and hearing about all the different, you know, issues that they run up against, ideas that they have, and just ways of making change.
Well, it's so broad, the whole animal world, and there's just so many different people fighting for different things, that it is a place where everything kind of connects.
Yeah, we're in a really lovely position, a unique position, I think, of straddling all of these different types of advocacy.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for today. Yeah. Thank you for everything that you guys are doing. It's incredible. And everyone needs you. And so it's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
To learn more about Joe and to learn about Funnelytics, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please rate, review, and subscribe to Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. Go to speciesunite.com and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.